Welcome to Conversations in Cannabis. Today's episode features Lauren Carpenter, co-founder and CEO of California-based cannabis retailer Embark. This episode was recorded online, February 10th, 2022.
Yeah, I think that we might get shell shocked once Florida legalizes for at least our tourism market.
But yeah. I think, it'll also spark an interesting conversation around consumption, right? And I think in California, is, you know, our business model is really predicated on winning retail licenses rather than buying them, right? So that means 2 years of conversation with each community, right? And a lot of the NIMBYism and a lot of the fear. And I, you know, it's weird. I straddle this line where in the industry, you know, we all understand cannabis and its role in community and who consumes it and how they consume it so differently. And then you have to have those conversations where people are still, you know, thinking it's only 17-year-old kids in the back alley that are consuming, right? And so in a way, I think it would be great. Like, imagine those pictures and consumption spaces, and it's all 55 plus, and we get to walk around to communities and be like, see, we told you, all of your friends are consuming cannabis.
Well, 100%. And I feel like one thing, and I was talking to Skip from Pacific Stone about which was like, if you look at the benefits of the 2018 Farm Bill, I think that CBD coming to proliferation of the mainstream culture kind of helped those people who are hesitant to see cannabis in their community. If they start seeing it on CVS shelves as like creams and ointments and stuff like that, you know, it starts to become part of their cultural vernacular. And it's just like, it's no longer this counterculture, you know, scary product that's kept behind barred windows and stuff like that. And I think, I mean, because when you look at states like North Dakota legalizing it, it's like, how did that happen? Because it doesn't really make sense. Like, the demographic isn't progressive for sure. When you really think about it, like, how many people in North Dakota are like truly getting high on a daily basis? And it has to be that wellness factor. And I mean, even in California, when you look at the drink companies, like, you know, Hi-Fi Hops or Jem and Jane or Can, you know, you're looking at more the move towards the micro dose versus the macro dose. Obviously, the younger crowd still dabbing hard, high THC flower. But like, I think that shift is starting to happen. That's really like, you know, when you see your aunt drinking a 2.5 milligram THC drink and she's not getting lit, you know, I think that's going to really help change perception.
Yeah. I mean, I stock Can in my house at all times so that when my dad comes over for Sunday night dinner, he can have Can. It's incredible. It's great that we get to, as I say to our team all the time, like, this is so cool that we get to help people feel good every day. And it's our job. Like, that's just, it's awesome. You know, I think sometimes we've lost sight of like the beautiful simplicity in that, right? It gets complicated by regulation and NIMBYism and all of those things. So,
yeah. Yeah. No, no. Regulation is, especially in the Golden State. hopefully it's going to get better. I know that the three departments merging was supposed to help with streamlining, but then again, you have the increase in taxation in January 1st at the grow level. I don't see regulations, at least from my perspective. I mean, you as an operator definitely are going to see it way more than I am. But I, like, from my perspective, unless they fix taxation in the state, I don't know how the DCC can really clamp down on illicit activity or illegal storefronts without having corrected the money problem. Because again, like let's say I'm somebody who only has $50 to my name, right? And I have to get meds. You know, you go to a dispensary, it's like, okay, get lower quality for, you know, a higher price point because of the taxation, the overregulations, you know, or go to the guy down the street and get it for $35. You know, like, do you think that the regulatory agency is eventually going to correct taxation, or do you think it's going to be a continual ramp up of minor increases?
My answer to that is really nuanced. I think the short answer to that is yes. I think the California government, particularly the regulatory agency, I live in Sacramento. My background is political. It's actually why I transitioned into cannabis was, you know, post-legalization, I saw an industry that had to figure out, like, how do you transition from the shadows into the light? I hate that terminology, right? But like, we all knew cannabis had been hiding in plain sight, and hiding from government and hiding from regulators and hiding from law enforcement. And in some ways, unfortunately, hiding from community. Like, cannabis is its own community. It's the thing that I think attracts everyone that's in this industry. It's what we're all fighting so hard to preserve, within the but how do we do that? Appreciating that this is not unique to cannabis. Any industry that professionalizes, you know, corporatizes in some ways and is regulated, that's all part of that process. And so how do you strike that balance? And I think in Sacramento, the conversations I'm hearing and participating in absolutely recognize the problem. I think the challenge or like the fine line the industry has to walk, which is particularly challenging as an operator, like, again, looking at our business model, it's really predicated on keeping government happy, right? I mean, operating a cannabis business, I say this all the time, to the point where it's, you know, it should be a drinking game at this point. It's a privilege, it's not a right. This isn't something we get a license and we get to just keep doing this. I opened a store 2 days ago and there are currently DCC officers and they're doing a surprise inspection. Like, literally, it's been a day and a half. You know what I'm saying? Like, and luckily it's going well. So not hot off the presses there, but my point, I apologize. I was getting that text message as I was looking down 2 minutes
ago. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing with regulators. I mean, you guys just, that was your Fairfield location, correct?
Yes. We opened a day and a half ago.
And they're already in there. Well, at least they're being proactive. I really wish they were that proactive with the gorilla grows and shit like that. But
I think, you're telling me. So I think, you know, I have a tremendous, as an operator, I have a tremendous amount of frustration. You know, I'll tell you recently, we had to have a long conversation with regulatory agencies because our website said Fairfield store coming soon. And we had to have a come to Jesus with them that wasn't marketing or advertising. And we had to have a conversation about, you know, the fact that obtaining these licenses is fundamentally taking so long, as, you know, these agencies are consolidating. This is new forms, new paperwork. And obviously now with the transition away from provisionals and into annuals and blah, 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 like that has very real world economic consequences for businesses. Full stop. And so I think as an operator, I share these frustrations. And as you know, my husband worked in the legalization movement on the policy front for 10 years. And so I also have this interesting perspective where I wear two hats of, you know, I had a real inside look at how the sausage was made. And to understand politics is to know that that process is always gross and messy, right? Like, but there were 500 something stakeholders at the table just trying their hardest to move the ball forward. And I think now more than ever, like now is when we make the tweaks to sustain this industry. I don't think anyone knew the right way to legalize cannabis in a nation state in the fifth largest economy in the world. Like, I don't think anyone knew how to do that. And so I think everyone sat down and as we know in politics, 500 people at the table means there's a lot of negotiation and trade-offs because you have to get things through. And I think now is the time to make tweaks, but it's challenging because how do you scream from the rooftops, we need this now, when the people you are screaming at are the same people who ultimately get to decide whether to come and do an inspection of your business or whether you get to get your license renewed or anything else, right? And so I think it's that too is not unique to cannabis. I think we're just in our infancy in terms of being a legalized industry and having to figure out how to navigate that. And I think, you know, we were the concessionaire for Outside Lands, Grasslands at Outside Lands this year. And we had 30 DCC regulators on site for that event. And, you know, it means I didn't sleep for 4 days because I knew nothing could go wrong. And, you know, and someone was seeing everything. But I think what I'm trying to do is lean into this as an opportunity to educate. Like, there were, you know, so many opportunities during outside lands where we would sort of pull a regulator over and say, which, and it was risky to do this and say like, hey, so this is how we have to do this, right? Like per section, blah, 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 blah. We have to do move this product like this from here to 4 feet over like that, right? And here's how, like, let's watch that process. Now here's the logical way in which one would do this. And it's obviously different than the way we're doing it right now, right?
Do you think at least regulators are starting to understand this? Cause I remember when I was sitting down with the guys that co-founded the OG Cannabis Cafe, and I was trying mm-hmm. to figure out like how they got around certain aspects of the law in order to do what they were doing. And they're like, oh, well, this address is designated as a restaurant and this address is a cannabis dispensary delivery service. And we're really just delivering food from one address to the next address as a delivery service. And I was like, if you're a regulator, and you're looking at people having to jump through these loopholes, like how stupid is that? You know what I mean? Like it's the same, to me, it's the same thing that happened here in Nevada. Like, you know, they legalized adult use cannabis. They said, okay, well, we want to model it after alcohol. And then you had vertically integrated companies, people who were growing cannabis in the back of their retail storefronts had to pay alcohol distributors to take flower literally 10 feet from their back room to their front room. And they had to pay a nasty premium for it. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, thankfully regulators like looked at that and they said, okay, yeah, that's not intelligent. So we're right. going to stop that. You guys can have your own distribution networks. If you guys want to get your own distribution licenses in order to move your own product from your back to your front, by all means, you shouldn't have to hire somebody from a different industry to walk 10 feet. Right. But in California, like I feel like it's such a big market and there's so much bureaucracy that it's kind of hard for the regulators. I mean, especially, you know, seeing people like social use applicants, like sit there for 2-3 years, having full build outs, continuously getting inspected before getting their applications approved. Like, are you seeing from your side that regulators are finally starting to get it? Or do you think that like, there's time for them to still learn the lesson?
Both, which is terrifying. You know, I think the industry has to survive. And, you know, what I realized having 30 regulators on site in my 4 days of no sleep, what I realized in a couple moments is, you know, I'm someone who came from government affairs. I, you know, elected officials are sir and ma'am, and, you know, because that's sort of the world I was raised in so many ways. And so appreciating the power regulators have over the day-to-day operations of our business, I was obviously super intimidated. And I think by the end of that, I realized they're just people. It doesn't mean I agree with every decision. It does, like, let me be clear. I am not the defender of regulators in the state of California. But I think taking a step back, I realized in that moment, you know, there were a couple great conversations, like I said, where I was able to pull someone over and say, I want you to see this in real time. And obviously we're going to continue to do it this way at this event, but like, boy, it would be great if by next year we could do that differently. And I right. think, and I think there was a receptiveness to that. I think like I saw that group then say, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, what if we did blah, blah, blah instead, right? And I'm like, well, let's make a couple tweaks to that idea too. But I think that's the challenge. That's walking the fine line, is you can get angry. And trust me, when I get a phone call about coming soon Fairfield on our website, like I get angry because it feels like of all the things, you know,
nitpicking.
Like just let me open the doors in a store before we, you know what I'm saying? Like, come on. Yeah. But I think the flip side is, you know, there's also, I think, there was that glimmer of hope of like, yeah, you know, if we sit down at a table, we can actually talk through some of these things, which, you know, I mean, look, I think that what else can you do? What else do you do?
I'm kind of interested to hear from your perspective on is like, look at Los Angeles County, right? Like you have somebody like Cat Packer who may not have been somebody who's actually a plant touching person before, but they were at least an advocate and they had been involved in the legalization process and they understand some of the trials and tribulations of some of the business owners. When you're looking at the DCC, do you feel like there's not enough people maybe on the regulatory office side that have been involved in cannabis businesses to be able to relate that personality or that those problems that maybe you know, a retailer would go through in a niche situation that maybe a regulator might not ever see. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, obviously they talk with people who are in the businesses every single day, but you know, being somebody that maybe they retired or they did an M&A and they've sold out their positions in their business. And they say, hey, you know, maybe I want to become a regulator and help, you know, tell these people from our perspective, exactly what's happening. Do you think that, you know, might be something that DCC needs?
I think it would be great and it wouldn't hurt. I think my general thought is the more the merrier. I don't think that there's a one size fits all approach to sort of addressing the woes that our industry is facing in California. I think, you know, addressing taxation is obviously important. And I think it's an incremental step. I think there are probably 100 or 1,000 if you brought the industry together. I think there would be so many other things that we could identify. So I think, you know, look, I would love to see more operators kind of make that transition into the space, because I think in all ways that could only be a benefit. And I think the other piece is, you know, as an industry, we have a lot of, because we're so new as an industry, right? The legal cannabis has been around forever, but the legal industry is so new. We have a lot of, you know, kind of associations and organizations, right? Like you have the CCIA, you have the UCBA, you have the keep going, the manufacturers, the distributors, the beverage, the blah, blah, blah. And I think, you know, my background pre-cannabis, I worked with the business community on really like tough, complex regulatory issues sort of across the game. And I've worked with restaurants, I've worked with industries. And the thing about all of those industries is they had been legalized for decades or centuries, right? And so what they had was a unified voice. There was, you know, it wasn't to say that there weren't, you know, chapters or a splinter group here or there, but there was really a singular association that, you know, after 50 years or 100 years had sort of consolidated to be that voice for the industry. And I think, you know, each of these industry groups are doing a great job. And you know, and I get they tend to focus, whether it's regional or based on, you know, what component of the value chain they exist in. But I think there's, you know, it's a two-way street. Like, I think it would be great to see more operators transition, you know, to your question, transition into a regulatory role because of that sort of subject matter expertise. And I think it would also be great we're starting to see this movement coalesce, you know, that if the industry sort of continued to come together and unify behind, I think for a long time, we've had this group's agenda and this group's agenda and this group's agenda because they're, you know, value chain component specific or whatever. Right. And I think it makes a lot of noise because, again, we all recognize we can't change 100% of things at once. So it is exciting to see the industry really unifying around tax reform, because I think it's one clear unified message that allows government to say, okay, I hear you, let's work on this. I mean, in theory, right? Hopefully, knock on wood. And then I think we go from there. You know, as a retailer, obviously my perspective is going to be biased by the unique sort of regulatory challenges retailers face. But as I take a step back, I can also look and say, you know, expanded access to retail benefits me as a retailer. My business model is predicated on it, but also taking a step back, you know, it helps meet need across the supply chain. So I think that's where every component of the supply chain can start coming together. I think we're really seeing that. I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what does that approach look like? I think we're already seeing in some ways a slight nuance or a slight softening of the message, which I think is important because, again, we are all just people. And so I think at the end of the day, like, human nature is to want to work with other people that we like or that aren't screaming at us, right? So I think I share the frustration, and trust me, there are many times I scream, but I think I'm excited to see us starting to unify around us being the California cannabis industry around a more succinct immediate needs platform, because I think that is a more realistic way of enacting incremental change.
Well, when you're looking at some of these lobby groups, I mean, you mentioned the CCIA, obviously that's more localized versus something like the NCIA, which is more nationalized. Are you hopeful that if they don't at least start to, you know, merge together, are you hopeful that at least they start to work together? Because it seems like I'm seeing a lot of sniping between the lobby groups based on their own personal agendas versus everybody saying like, look, let's all target one specific problem at a time. And then we can kind of work on our own individual issues as we go along. Because I mean, right now, at least on the federal side, especially in relation to Canada or any other type of country that's already done federal legalization, like intellectual property, like on the international scale, like we're going to be way behind as the United States in terms of branding and international business in the cannabis industry. But even on the state side, I mean, you know, having somebody like the NCIA and the CCIA get into fights over, you know, nuanced things, it feels like it's counterproductive. Do you think that will eventually take that kind of alcohol lobby approach where they'll start to become like a more unified voice? I mean, obviously beyond just taxation, everybody wants taxation and banking reform, but more as far as like beyond that part or intellectual property or, you know, getting some kind of regulatory push through for interstate commerce. I know the West Coast had tried to do something like that. I know it's still covered by the federal government, but I mean, are you hopeful for that in the future?
The more unified we become, the more impactful we are. I mean, that's just, again, like that's not revolutionary. We've seen every other industry do it. I think I attribute a lot of the struggle and the strife, I think, to our infancy. And with, you know, this is both a mature and an incredibly immature market at the same time. And there's inherent conflict in that. And so I think, it would only behoove us for us to all unify. That said, I think part of the challenge is we are all talking about, you know, critical aspects of the industry that, again, I don't think have a one size fits all answer. I mean, you talk to every group about social equity and there's often a very different perspective on what advancing social equity policy looks like or whether policy is the solution. And is, you know, a huge school of thought that banking reform would be the single most impactful, way to move the needle for social equity operators because of a lack of access to capital. And, you know, in some ways I tend to agree. It's really easy for me to sit and be like, yeah, I totally think that we should all get along and unify, right? I think it's years before we effectively do that. I think, unfortunately, and I think it's, but I think, let you know, looking to California, like, let's get a win, California. We've asked for tax reform. I think, you know, we see some signals that that is being heard. So let's see what coming together can do and let's see how that moves the needle. And then, you know, and I think that allows us to then take up the next issue. And I think it's only through feeling the success of that coming together that we can kind of, you know, continue to do that or double down on that unification. But, you know, it's also hard. Like, this is an industry that has a lot of personalities and a lot of cult of personalities, right? And so, I think, yeah. You know, there are a lot of folks who've built their brand around their personal brand or their, you know, their professional brand or maybe both, with a very specific and strong perspective on something. And on the one hand, I respect that because if, you know, you stand for nothing, you know, that saying, right? But on the other hand, I think, you know, that too makes this challenging because then you see finger pointing and, you know, and everything else. And at the end of the day, that doesn't move the ball forward. It doesn't move the needle.
Well, being an operator, I mean, is there a particular brand, not necessarily in the retail aspect, but, you know, a particular flower brand or concentrate brand or even ancillary market brand that you feel is like helping move that paradigm for the industry?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm like, it's much easier for me to tell you my favorite brands to consume. I think there are a lot of brands doing things and a lot of groups doing things in unique and interesting ways. I don't think there's one group that stands out to me as, you know, this is the example. I continue to be, you know, you meet people that are doing things interesting and in incremental ways all the time. I love Pure Beauty. I think they're You know, they came from like a very interesting New York background, and I think they're pushing the needle in interesting ways, sort of creatively and aesthetically, to move outside of this paradigm of just, you know, sort of like attractive packaging and like really continuing to root cannabis in art, which I think is, you know, especially with some of their recent collaborations, which, you know, how long have artists been consuming cannabis? Like, it's great when we can root it in that, you know. I think there are groups, you know, there, I was talking with someone the other day out of the Bay Area who owns a distribution company for equity, you know, Bay Area equity brands. And he and some of his partners have created a, like a national, I don't want to botch this and sort of misrepresent it, but an equity trade certification at the national level. And they're now pushing to have that implemented in California. I think that's really interesting because it's creative. You know, as we look at how do social equity brands, you know, in this fight for shelf space in California with too few shelves to begin with, and, you know, so many dispensaries not able to pay their bills right now, sort of artificially limiting the number of shelves even further. Like, I think that's a super interesting approach to providing a unique point of differentiation for products that I think could be very successful in California and beyond. So I think there are definitely, and those are obviously just two examples, but I think there are companies doing cool things, you know, for sure.
Well, and consumer education is obviously shifting, right? So like during the 215 days, it was all, what's the highest THC percentage I can get? And I know that that still has some prevalence in some geographical areas within California and across the United States, but the new kind of movement seems to be terpenes, the totality of the entourage effects, you know, smaller cannabinoids. Do you think that that type of consumer shift is going to continue to happen? Or do you think that there will be a complete divergence of the consumer base where you, again, you have one more of a connoisseur kind of level where it's like they only care about the terpenes and they only care about, you know, the quality of the grower versus, you know, say that standardized consumer currently, or the 215 era consumer, which is like, you know, I want 30% or I don't want to buy. Where do you think that the consumer market is eventually going?
I think the California industry over-indexed on the soccer mom or the Chardonnay mom or the fill in the Lululemon mom, whatever, you know, they, whatever company, fill in the blank company has decided to call them. I think they over-indexed early on that market segment maturing more quickly than we've seen happen. I think, you know, the folks that keep the lights on in a dispensary by coming every day or multiple times a week are, you know, those folks, those daily consumers are still the ones that are, you know, like I said, kind of keeping the lights on for dispensaries. But I think we are absolutely seeing that shift. I think operators are not being truthful if they don't acknowledge that, you know, a significant portion of the consumers that come through their doors are still asking, what is the highest THC for the lowest price point that I can get? And I think there's this interesting dynamic where it's, you know, it's a bit of a limbo. It's a bit of a race to the bottom right now in that, and we're all feeding into that. And now we can go get wholesale eights for $3, which, I mean, I think is just a disservice to us all, right? And I mean, starting with the farmer. So I think it's a weird moment in time to be talking about California consumer. I also think we're in this weird cycle. Negative headlines feed insecurity around the industry, and insecurity around the industry because of regulation and other things are feeding these negative headlines. And so, you know, I hope we see, I am still incredibly bullish on California and incredibly bullish on the way that California consumer base is continuing to evolve and develop. Again, you know I've said this, but we are in our infancy. And so I think, you know, as an industry, we have to be careful not to over-index on any one consumer, because I think it's still really evolving. And, you know, for our retail, we aren't in LA, we aren't in San Francisco, we are in sort of secondary markets. And I say that with no disrespect to any of the communities we operate in, right? But these are, you know, we're in Martinez and Alameda and South Lake Tahoe and Fairfield. These are, you know, these are communities that have not historically had cannabis, you know, legal cannabis operations in them. And so we're still just, I think, getting to know those consumers. And through consistent access to cannabis, those consumers are rapidly changing in what their consumption profile looks like. And so I think, you know, that's it's exciting to sort of just be at the beginning of that evolution. And, you know, as someone who enjoys cannabis, I want nothing more than to see the conversation evolve beyond THC percentages and price points, not, you know, not just because of what that does to everyone's business across the supply chain. But I think just because it's so reductionist in how we look at the plan. And, you know, I was talking to someone last night who was telling me he had gone into a dispensary in LA, cause I'm, you know, I'm down here for this conference, and I was getting dinner with someone, and he said, you know, he had done, you know, he has found a cannabinoid that works really well for him. And he'd gone into a couple dispensaries trying to find a product and absolutely was running into walls with the, you know, no one on the team being able to work with him on that. And so I think, you know, to be honest, as retailers, we have a long way to go in bringing, I think, in remaining true and prioritizing that education for our teams and therefore for consumers. You know, there's always going to be the consumer that knows exactly what they want, and they come in and they want to be out in 2 minutes. But I think, you know, it is a surprising percentage of people, even of those consumers, who are actually really open to having the conversation. Well, why are you carrying this instead of that? Tell me about that. What was the thought process behind that? You know, I was talking to someone in Fairfield yesterday. Well, what is Moon Made, right? We carry this product from Moon Made Farms. Well, what is Moon? I've heard of Sun Grown. What's Moon Made? And I'm like, oh, get ready. Let me talk to you about the lunar cycle, right? So it's fun. You know, it's fun to be able to have those conversations with people and to have them get excited and, you know, go home and tell their friends about the lunar cycle, right? Like, cool.
Yeah. And I mean, like, again, when you look at the consumer level, I mean, a lot of them just assume weed just grows. They're not thinking, oh, is this light depth? Is this greenhouse? Right. Is this indoor hydroponically grown? Is this indoor soil organic grown? Like, so yeah, I mean, so the education of the consumer is definitely getting better. But as far as, again, that general consumer that's just saying, I want the highest THC percentage, I think that that's going to start to die. As a retailer, do you think that you're seeing less and less of that? Because, I mean, to me, if taking an analogy with the alcohol industry, right? Like, is Everclear the highest selling alcohol in the nation, which is the highest THC, or I'm sorry, the highest BAC percentage. So, or whatever, the highest alcohol per volume percentage. So is that, I don't drink. So is that the best, is that the best alcohol in the market? And, you know, when you're really looking at things, it's like, it's nowhere even near the highest selling alcohol in the market. And the same thing in the concentrates market, like, is THC crystalline the best selling concentrate on the market? It's the highest THC percentage, you know, 97 plus. And I, like, are you starting to see people, like, literally ask more about, you know, what is contained within the product beyond just, you know, hey, what's the THC percentage? Like, why does this taste this way? Are you starting to see more educated questions coming from the consumers?
Yes. I think, you know, so we opened our first store in June of 2020. So we've only existed as a retailer in the pandemic. So actually, like, I think it's gonna be really interesting if we can navigate this time. I like bring it up, bring on anything else, right? And so I think in some ways people had time during a pandemic. And so I think we found people willing actually to spend more time in the store and ask those questions. And through asking those questions, they then start to pay attention to, you know, well, how does that make me feel and why? And do I like that? And do I want something else? So yeah, I mean, I think that is certainly evolving. I think there are market forces and dynamics at play. You know, we're seeing a lot of coupon customers, right? The folks who are going online to find the absolute cheapest and you know, and it's eroding loyalty. Like, we are not experiencing that as retail. I think as an industry, we are experiencing the rise of, you know, the coupon customer. And so I think there's a push-pull in that. And I think retail plays an important part in an important counterbalance to that, right? There is always going to be a customer that goes online and goes to a few websites we all know well and sees who has, you know, well, they're charging $12 and they're charging $20, right? And there's always going to be a consumer who makes their decision based on that. But I think that's where I still see brick and mortar playing an important role, particularly for customers who are looking to have that more sort of like wellness journey conversation. You know, to be able to come in and there are a lot of people who we were talking at the beginning of this about Florida and baby boomers. You know, I think that's a market segment that's coming back to cannabis for the first time in a long time. It's obviously an overgeneralization. There are many who've stayed with cannabis that whole time, but I think that's an exciting market segment because, you know, that's a group that, again, oversimplifying here, but who, you know, oh, well, you know, this is much stronger than back when I was consuming. And that's a fun place to start, right? Because we're like, all right, let's open up the gamut. You know, I love nothing more than when, you know, a senior citizen comes in and says, I want to get high, right? I'm like, great. Let's start there. This is going to be fun, right? Like that's a fun day. And I think that's also, you know, we were talking earlier about sort of destigmatizing and the not in my backyard contingency that we still have to fight so hard in order to get retail licenses in these communities. And I think, you know, that's what we're fighting for, is to be able to have those conversations and for it to be okay. You know, a lot of folks in that age bracket are coming in to, you know, address aches and pains and to, you know, reduce use of pharmaceuticals. And that's fantastic. And that's plant medicine at work. But I think it's also plant medicine at work when someone comes in and says, hey, I really want to get high. Like I haven't gotten high in 20 years. Like, where do I start? You know?
Well, and a lot of the fear also, I feel like that's starting to become tempered is the fact that, you know, a lot of people during the early days of, you know, marketable cannabis, like say in the 60s and 70s, where people are openly selling to other friends and stuff like that, like, you know, it becoming more and more prolific. And then you look at the cannabis the 215 medical area of cannabis in California, you know, you're looking at edibles or you're looking at drinks and tinctures, you know, where dosing might not have been as stabilized as it is now. So for instance, like if you eat a brownie during the 215 days, you might eat a corner that has all the hash in it, and then the rest of the brownie has nothing. You're out of your mind.
Right.
And your friend's not even high. Yeah. So I think
the hot bite, for sure.
I think that the ability for, you know, 55 plus people to be able to say, okay, well, now I can take a regulated dose. I can start to figure out exactly what I need to be able to reach a level where I feel not only comfortable, but I feel like the wellness is actually kicking in. My aches are less, my anxiety is less, whatever it is. I feel like dosing in cannabis has really helped placate that and bring in a lot of those people who had probably had bad experiences during 215 or during the 60s and 70s. Do you think that education around dosing, you know, because again, most people assume just, hey, eat the whole chocolate bar, you're going to be good. But as far as like, you know, bud tenders telling, you know, people like, hey, just take one little square, see how you feel, and then wait a little bit. This isn't like the 215 days. It's not like, you know, the 60s and 70s. We have actual SOPs, which give you guaranteed dosing levels of, you know, per bite. Do you feel people are becoming more comfortable taking that chance now?
For sure. And I think it is every day that someone comes into one of the shops and says, you know, oh, I had a bad experience with edibles. And I think it's not the nostalgia of that hot bite, you know, 15 years ago. It's in today's market with today's products too, where it's this, I took two, right? And I wasn't feeling anything after 3 minutes. So I decided to take four more. And then I couldn't get off my couch and I really freaked out. And, you know, I thought I was having a heart attack. Right. And so I think, so dosing is step one, right? Having that, I think that is helpful. And then conversation is step two, right? Because they can leave with a dosable product and still not dose in a way that facilitates the experience they're looking for. And then, you know, and then fear around that experience keeps them from coming back.
Right.
So we're in the infancy of that being really effective.
Well, and you know, like we were talking about earlier with Gem and Jane or Can, you know, the ability to have a microdosable product that even if you drink the whole can, like you're probably not going to get lit off of 2.5 milligrams, but you might be able to gauge how you feel off of drinking that whole can and say, you know, one can is all I need, or maybe, you know, two throughout a 4-hour session is all I need. you know, versus say, I'm going to guess how much of this I'm going to drink from a 1,000-milligram bottle during the 215 days and hope for the best.
I'm going to have a cap goal.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and hopefully that doesn't, it, hopefully you shook it up enough and it doesn't have all of it in one cap. But yeah, so, you know, I'm curious to see where the market's going to take, especially the consumers that have had bad experiences. I do think it's getting better, and I'm glad to hear from a retailer's perspective that you see that it's starting to get better as well. You just opened, because I know I only have you for a couple more minutes. I've actually kept you longer than I should have. I know you guys just opened your location, your newest location in Fairfield. When you're deciding on locations that you'd want to open, and you're looking at locations that you think are going to be perfect for your brand, what are some kind of KPIs that you look at and say, you know, this spot is perfect for Embark?
So we've taken a really measured approach to growth. And, you know, as I mentioned before, our growth is exclusively through these super tough knife fights at this point, you know, merit-based licensing processes. And we've been really deliberate in not, you know, just because a community is opting to move forward with licensing does not mean we've applied there. And I think we look for a few things. There are obviously some of the key sort of business metrics around, you know, licenses against population numbers. We don't want to be, well, first, limited versus unlimited, right? Like if you're going to expend the energies to compete, then the goal is not that this becomes a completely oversaturated market. I think so you're looking at and doing that analysis of number of licenses against a population. You're also, you know, because I run into retailer, what I call the aspirational pro forma all the time, where their stores are going to do $40 million a year forever for the end of time, right? And so I also look at a map and I look at what's around it. And I look at, you know, which communities have licensed cannabis today and which communities are going to have licensed cannabis based on sort of political and social and cultural dynamics in 1, 2, and 5 years. And obviously it's our hope that all cannabis, you know, all communities have access to cannabis. That's a huge problem plaguing the industry. But I think, you know, from a business perspective, we have to look at communities where it makes sense. Real estate is still a huge component of this. You know, I was sniffing around in a potential community recently that we were looking at potentially applying in, and the most affordable real estate I could find was $55,000 a month. And as you look at factors 1 and 2 that I just shared, how many licenses per capita, what other communities are coming online over the next, you know, 12 to 36 months, you know, you may have a store that's going gangbusters in that community for 12 months, but the realities of this market and the eventual increase in access to retail is going to dramatically change the performance of that store. And that's not a, you know, but that real estate is not a cost that's going to change with it. And so I think, you know, it's where we go is an exercise in keeping your ego in check, right? Around like, does this actually, I may want to be here. I may think that I should be here, but like, does this actually make sense? Are we setting that team up to succeed, right? And then I think the other equally critical part, there's the business consideration. And then there's the community consideration. And, you know, I transitioned into cannabis a handful of years ago, working for, at the time, you know, one of the largest cannabis operators probably in the world. And it was through that experience where, you know, I was really the tip of the spear in representing that company into going into communities to ascertain their comfort with increased access to retail. And this was a number of years ago where it was a harder conversation and, you know, nonprofits weren't coming to the table in partnership and all these things that we see today. And so I think that really informed our approach around finding communities where we think Embark as a business will fundamentally be a good fit, because you want to find a community where, you know, we have a unique-ish approach to retail. You know, we have a bodega model. We spend more time educating our bud tenders. We call them guides, you know, before they go out on the floor. So it is, it's a lighter, brighter, more educational experience. And so is this a community that wants that and is going to value that? And so I think we've found communities that have, you know, in some cases, some reticence to usher in legal cannabis. And I think that's where we find our sweet spot, because in every community where we operate, we create a community advisory board These are folks who often are really, again, reticent to see cannabis come. These are pastors and school board members and nonprofit leaders. And we bring them to the table in a very deliberate way, you know, sometimes years before we ever submit the application, to make sure that there's sort of philosophical alignment between Embark and the community. Because I think that goes back to my first point, which is, you know, that's how you ensure the business's success.
Well, and when you're looking at kind of the areas that you're selecting, I mean, obviously you've had pretty good growth in the last year and three quarters. So you mentioned that you're not in any major metropolitan areas in California. I mean, South Lake Tahoe is pretty, it may not be Los Angeles, but there's a lot of people that are going through South Lake Tahoe. Are you guys hopeful to eventually get into a metropolitan area? Or are you going to stay in the niche community? And is it possible for an out-of-state expansion in the future?
I never say never to anything, because, you know, if anyone tells you they have a 5-year plan in this industry, they're out of their minds. We all have 5-year aspirations, but we cannot stay aligned with that plan. This is the name of the game, is pivoting. But I think, having said that, you know, today we are very focused and very disciplined. We started as a Northern California cannabis company because really because I'd read an interview once from one of the leadership team members at In-N-Out, who said, you know, why are they not global? And that team member said, because I want to be able to go into every store and know, you know, the team members' names. And I think because, as we've talked about earlier, this is such a highly regulated industry, because the consequences of mistakes, and, you know, we are all human, right? But the consequences of a human error can be the ability to continue operating your business. We stayed really locally focused. I wanted to be about 2 hours from any of our stores so I could be there and get my hands dirty and, you know, sleep in my own bed that night. I think we've had success. You know, we have 10 licenses today, so 4 stores open, the other 6 will be coming online. We found success in this sort of, like, I think, thoughtful growth model, you know, kind of community-centric growth model. And so we're creeping a little outside of my 2-hour mark now. We're selected in Fresno, so we'll be opening in Fresno later this year, which is a little outside of that thesis, and have just started some Southern California expansion. Again, I think trying, though, to be pretty deliberate about what those communities are. So I see a broader California footprint in our future. And then I think, you know, that's where I'm going to stay focused. Is this is the 5th largest economy in the world. And, you know, despite onerous regulations and pretty jarring headlines and all of the things that I think make people nervous and scared in some ways of the California market, I believe in the California consumer. I am bullish on the California consumer. And so I just want to see, you know, I want to see what we can achieve here. And I think I'll be really proud of whatever that ultimately looks like.
Well, I mean, you're obviously crushing it right now. I think you're going to continue to crush it into the ongoing future. And you're right. I mean, California is 5th largest economy in the world, but not just that, it is the largest adult use market in the world. Until the United States legalizes on a federal level, I think that's going to stay that way for a long time. I really appreciate your time. I look forward to seeing what you guys got going on in the future, especially as it relates to what you're doing with events, because I think that that's also going to help destigmatize cannabis as a whole, being able to see somebody decide, I don't want to go to the beer tent, I would rather go get a joint. I think that that's going to help a lot.
And it's doing it at scale.
Yeah.
You know, it's not 200 people or 400 people coming through your shop in a day, it's 200,000. I mean, think about how many hearts and minds we're influencing over the course of a weekend.
We would like to thank Lauren for her time and being on today's episode. You can find out more about Embark by visiting them online at www.goembark.com. Again, that's www.goembark.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you here on the next episode of Conversations in Cannabis.